On this episode, we're talking with perhaps the most well-known retail researcher in the world. Paco Underhill is joining us to talk about the science of shopping. You're listening to Where We Buy. My name is James Cook. I research retail and real estate for JLL. This is the show where we talk with retail experts and visit shopping places. Last month in early December, Taylor Coyne and I were in New York. We were walking down Broadway. It was a cold morning, and I have to admit to you, I was kind of nervous. We were looking for the offices of EnviroCell. So Paco Underhill is the CEO and founder of EnviroCell, and he's one of the pioneers in doing something that a lot of people do now, using the tools of anthropology to study how people shop and then improve retail design. So here's where things might get a little confusing. I made a dumb decision a few years ago, and it's still haunting me to this day. And it's the reason why almost nobody gets the name of this podcast right. Okay, so the deal is Paco's most famous book, his best-selling book, is called Why We Buy, The Science of Shopping. And this podcast is called Where We Buy. Are you confused? You're not alone. And that's why I was a little bit nervous, because way back when I had meant the title of this podcast, Where We Buy, as an homage to Paco Underhill, but I didn't know what he actually thought about it. I had no idea if he'd see it that way. So we found the building where EnviroCell's offices were in, and we were soon seated at a table in Paco's office. And I got a chance to ask him the question that had been weighing on my mind.
So when I started this podcast a few years ago, I was trying to think of a name, and I looked up on the shelf and I saw your book, Why We Buy. And I thought, oh, but what I do is about real estate, so it should be Where We Buy. And without thinking twice that there'd be any confusion in the world, I just said, oh, that's what we'll call the podcast. And now it's been a few years down the road, and I should ask you, you're not going to sue me, are you?
There are so many people that have riffed off my book here, and that if I sued all of them, I'd be in court forever. But I also think that that riffing is a form of flattery, so that's how I'm trying to take it.
So, Paco, the first time I became aware of you, I was in college, and this would have been in the mid-90s, and I couldn't sleep one night, and I turned on NPR, and Why We Buy come out?
The book Why We Buy came out in 1999, but my two entries into the world of media, one was a profile done in Smithsonian Magazine, which was out in 1993. And the other was a profile of the business that we have here done by a young Canadian science writer named Malcolm Gladwell.
That
came out in...
I'm sure that helped you.
in 1996. And that went on to become the most reprinted piece at that point in New Yorker history.
Fantastic piece. I think everybody's read it. But so I heard you on an NPR interview in my local NPR station. I lived in Philadelphia. I was blown away. I did not have any sense that you could treat the retail environment as a scientist, as an anthropologist. And it was so cool to hear that.
I am by training an urban geographer. I used to teach in the doctoral program in environmental psychology. Here at City University in New York. And I was part of the crew that would rewrite commercial zoning ordinances for different cities across the country. And the story I tell is I had my moment of professional epiphany on the roof of a 60-story building in Seattle, where there was a stiff wind blowing. I was installing the time-lapse cameras to record the traffic patterns on the streets below, and I could feel the building rocking in the breeze, and realized that I probably had to reinvent my profession because I don't like heights, even though I'm 6'5". And a week later, I was standing in a bank in New York City and realized that the same tools that I, as an urban planner or a urban geographer, had been using to try to understand how a city worked, that I could take inside a bank or a store or an airport or a museum or even a hospital or doctor's office and try to deconstruct how to do it better.
Well, you and I kind of, as we're sort of talking about what we're going to talk about today, you'd mentioned that in the retail world, some things are constants and some things are in flux in the environment. What did you mean by that? How's your take on that?
One of the things that both of us love about retail is that it is often the reflection of social change. Retail is a great dipstick to look at the evolution of people. And what is the difference between how we shopped or how we acquired or how we consumed in 1999 versus 2019 is a really nice treatment. And there's a series of issues that are germane to that topic. By the same token, we are also biological beings. And there are a series of, at least for now, still biological constants that govern what I call the science of shopping. Some of it is ergometrics, which is the science of human measurements, meaning that there are some very defined ways in which we as human beings deal with distance. One. Second is that 90% of us are right-handed. Okay. And this is my apologies to the southpaws of the world, but the simple concept that we often work better in physical spaces with a counterclockwise circulation because we tend to carry things with our left hand or on our left shoulder, and we tend to interact with our right. And whether I'm talking about the counter of an airport, or I'm talking about the way someone goes through a museum exhibit, or I'm talking about a store, in general, things work better with a counterclockwise circulation pattern. In about 10 days, I will turn 68. And one of the things that we know is that there is a predictability to the aging of the human eye, meaning that the way someone sees at age 25 and the way someone sees at age 40 or 50 or 68 are governed by some, again, biological constants. As we age, the lenses in our eyes yellow. The way I see color at 68 and the way Taylor, sitting at our desk here, sees color is a little different, okay? If I'm Abercrombie and Fitch, I know who my target market is. But if I'm JLL, or I'm Target, or I'm Walmart, or I'm Best Buy, or I'm Verizon Wireless, or I'm Nordstrom, being able to understand the difference between what an aging eye sees and what a young eye sees is a very important distinction. It is also pointed in that particular vein that if you go to the design studios, whether they're in Indiana or whether they're in London or New York or Paris or Jeddah, that the person sitting at the CAD/CAM screen doing the design work is generally under age 30, and they tend to design for themselves. The third function here, which is, again, an interesting one, is that there are globally prescribed social configurations that generally we hope that we like our spouses and that we love our children, okay? And that many of us are charged with the responsibility of looking out of both our children as well as our parents. And therefore, as we look at the way people move through space, there's a difference between moving alone, moving with a friend, moving with a spouse or a member of the opposite sex, or moving in a tribal cluster, which may be four guys or four women all together, moving as a nuclear family or moving as an extended family. Those are all examples of what the biological constants are. Okay? Now, let's back up and go, what's changed? What's different? So, First is the very fundamental premise that our visual language is evolving faster than our spoken or written word. Thanks to the internet, thanks to movies, the connection between our eyes and our brains. And therefore, in the developing world, okay, and when I talk about the design of a shopping mall, the design of a store, design of an airport, design of a doctor's office, design of a waiting room in a hospital, one of the critical issues is looking at what do we see and understanding what those cognitive differences are and distances are. And those often can make a profound impact on people's level of comfort, people's willingness to stay, people's willingness to absorb information. That also looks at the difference between images and words. And this is a very critical issue in a shrinking world, particularly in the shopping mall industry, where so many of our malls are serving an ethnically diverse customer base. If I look at Hudson Yards here in New York City, probably one of the most important customers coming to Hudson Yards is a Chinese tourist. Okay? And how do I take a Chinese tourist whose English skills may not be all of that terrific and be able to make them comfortable, knowing that they're a high-end spender? And I could take that ratio and look at the difference between how does Hudson Yards do it versus how do they do it in Ginza in Tokyo, where they actually have a little more experience dealing with that high-end Chinese tourist than we do here. So that's one, visual. Second is the evolving status of women. Okay. And I want to make no moral or religious judgment here, but probably the most seminal event in our species since we tamed fire is birth control. And that the fundamental uncoupling of sex from procreation is something that has profound impacts on the nature of the world. Historically, we sold women clothing, beauty, and apparel. Today, for example, in the broader world of technology, there is a mathematical correlation between a technology store and the number of women working on the floor and the success of that store. Because a woman walking in the door is not buying just for herself. She's buying for her children. She's often buying for her parents. And she would rather deal with a female nerd who doesn't look down at her than a male nerd that does. Okay? And whether we're talking about selling software or phones or cars or whatever, understanding the difference between a woman's perception of space and a man's perception of space is really key. And there are three things that we look at. One is security, meaning that if you asked a group of men, when was the last time you felt creepy, they'd have a hard time doing it, you know, particularly big guys like you and I, bro. Okay. Whereas if I was in a room of women and said, when was the last time you felt creepy? They could tell us something that happened in the mall, in the parking lot of a shopping mall, in an elevator lobby on a New York street. They could be inside the new Nordstrom's and something happened that made them feel funky. So that's security issues. Second is hygiene. And I think particularly for those of us in the both the retail and the real estate world, the recognition that the sooner in the planning process that we bring the issue of keeping it clean, the easier it is to keep it clean and the more likely it is to get clean. I can think of issues like the Javits Center, where it wasn't until the building was built that somebody figured out they were going to have trouble washing the windows. Or I think about a hotel room where there is often a correlation between the height of the chambermaid and the degree of cleanliness that you find in that room over a certain prescribed height. So if you think of a ledge on the top of a door, okay, and if your chambermaid is 5'3" and she can't get to that ledge, it doesn't get clean. You think about the shelf and the closet, honey. All of those aspects are things that define some of our design decisions. And that changing status of women to us is really important, because simply if you think about what makes it good for a female, it makes it good for all of us. It's a really nice lens to look at the world. So that's issue two. Issue three is that all of us are moving through our lives with a clock ticking inside our heads. And every time I walk into a shopping mall willing to spend the afternoon, or every time I walk into a Verizon Wireless, you know, willing to browse, there's another time when I'm desperate to get in and out as quickly as possible. And that issue of time and the operating culture of a space is a important one, because the easiest thing to change about a shopping mall or a store or an airport is the physical design. Hardest thing to change is the operating culture, and the degree to which I can make that responsible or responsive to that clock ticking inside a head is critical. Fourth issue is, what is global and what is local? I can be a global technology vendor selling phones or software, and I can be selling those phones in 112 countries across the world. And yet, the way someone shops that product in a first-tier Chinese city and a third-tier Chinese city is different. And if I take the dipstick of how does somebody buy it, the same thing in Guangzhou versus Singapore versus Antalya in Turkey versus Albany, New York, or San Francisco, they're all somewhat different. And the degree to which I respond to what those differences are. And particularly in the shopping mall world, it isn't that there's an infinite variety of buckets, but there are some very logical ones that can help an operator of stores or malls be able to apply the toolbox to be able to make that function better. And that for all of our focus on strategy, the, you know, McKinsey term or the Wharton or the Harvard School or whatever, that tactical execution is a really critical one. The final issue is, again, for those of us in the shopping and the development community, a really interesting one, is that we passed over a very magic moment in the mid-1990s. Up until the mid-1990s, the overwhelming majority of global wealth had been in the hands of an aristocracy. And we think about the evolution of shopping. We look at the French, the Dutch, who for 500 years, the Italians, another great example, were finding ways to sell things to people who understood the difference between something that was cheap and something that was expensive. That there's a reason why this t-shirt at Walmart cost one price and this t-shirt at Primark might cost a little less, but this t-shirt bought at Selfridges or cost 10 times as much. In 2019, if I look at the 20 wealthiest people on Earth, 19 out of those 20 earned it in the course of their own lifetimes. And part of what that challenge means is that often, while many of them understand what the difference between a Fiat and a Tesla is, and they understand the difference between a penthouse apartment on Central Park South and a, you know, condo in the far edges of Brooklyn, that there are lots of other things that they don't get. And that often, in order to sell, we often have to educate. And that is part of what is driving this very interesting nexus between the cyber and the physical world. Because our use or access to our cyber information, as opposed to just products, is part of the way many of us across the world are adjusting and learning about what it means to be a smarter and more focused consumer.
Maybe could we go a little bit more into you have such a global understanding of shoppers in a way that, you know, Taylor and I focus on North America, so we don't have that. What, for example, say electronics, if I'm trying to sell electronics in different countries, what are some of the differences, specific differences that you face?
If I go in to a Brazilian telecom store, they are often organizing and merchandising products based on a woman's need. This is the phone for you if you're trying to manage both your job and your children. This is the phone and the plan for you if you travel more than 30 nights a year. This is the budget phone that is probably makes sense for you to acquire as the first phone for your 12-year-old. I mean, those are all simple things. But if you walk into a Verizon store here, nobody has organized it that way. Okay. And that's part of what that process is. Some of it is recognizing, again, in that technology world, is that we know that if I fail to solve a problem with my mobile phone service online, I fail to solve it over the phone, I go to the store. And that unlike any other type of retail, the number of people who walk into a telecom store angry or threatened is remarkably high. And that the idea that I am both doing sales and service in the same space, where I'm on the one hand trying to sell you a phone for hundreds or maybe even more than $1,000, and then literally 12 feet away, there is somebody complaining bitterly about the fact that her life is profoundly threatened because the bill hasn't gone to the right place, or that something hasn't worked in the context of this very expensive device that they just acquired. I think it was 3 months ago. I mean, those are all things. So, for example, there are many places where there's a telecom store, but there's a wall in the middle of it. And that wall, on one side of the wall, is service. And on the other side of the wall is sales. I mean, it's a very simple solutions. But, I mean, these are, again, examples of the way others in other parts of the world have been able to respond to it.
So I want to turn our conversation a little bit. You wrote a book about malls, The Call of the Mall, and we're in a time where a lot of people are saying, do we need malls anymore? Is that a mode of selling that is even relevant?
You know what's been really interesting, James, is that Call of the Mall was originally published in 2004, okay? And it went on to modest success. In the past year, Call of the Mall has exploded across the digital world, okay? And the number of digital versions of it that are downloaded in the 14 languages that it was in. I had a group of Russian mall executives who visited me yesterday or the day before yesterday, all of whom were clutching their Call of the Mall in Russian, you know, going, this was so wonderful. First of all, let's recognize that the mall outside the U.S. is doing just fine. And that is because outside the U.S., the mall has three seminal offerings. The first is security, okay? That if you're in India or you're in the Middle East or you're in Brazil, the street isn't safe, okay? And therefore, going to the mall is not only about shopping, but it's about socialization. And therefore, if you go to the mall in Brazil, you hear the clatter of fashionable footwear, not the squeak of sneakers, because people are going to the mall to be seen. That's one. Second is hygiene. Okay. that the mall generally offers a clean environment. If I deal with India or Pakistan or China, that level of hygiene, particularly to the female consumer, is a very important one. And the third is climate control. Okay. So that's one piece. The second piece of the puzzle is that all across the world, it is a combination of living, shopping, working, and entertainment all in the same place. For many of the shopping malls here in the U.S., their most misunderstood asset is the crumbling asphalt that surrounds the mall. If you think of whether you're in Minnesota or you're in St. Louis here, that there are lots of baby boomers, particularly at this particular moment in time, who are looking at some changes in housing. Do I want to leave my suburban home? Do I want to move to Florida? Do I want to be do I want to move to Tucson or Phoenix? Or would I rather be in a place where I'm closer to my family and my friends? And wouldn't it be nice if I had a wonderful condo where I could shop a grocery store in my bedroom slippers if I wanted to get much of my shopping done, or to even be able to have a job where I didn't have to drive my car? How do we reconfigure that mall to be a more complete solution to people's living issues? And that transformation doesn't happen in a quarter. That in order to take Gardens State Plaza and start to install housing in it, it is a minimum 2.5-year process. And can the shopping mall industry look at the Wall Street investor and say, please be patient, that I can take this crumbling B shopping mall whose tenant mix is fleeing and be able to transform it into an all? Hotels, housing, a grocery store, a drug store, a locksmith, hardware store, all in the same mall, recognizing that it often isn't what the tenants are paying for the commercial properties. It is the value of the broader real estate portfolio that exists there. If I look at Tokyo Midtown in Roppongi Hills, and you talk to the senior management there, they go, the apartments here rent for a premium because the tenant is so appreciative that they can shop for the things that they need and they don't have to leave the building.
I think the trick, it's funny, most of that kind of mixed use additions to shopping centers that we're seeing are in the Class A centers that already have the stores that people want to live near. Now, you'd talked about, take a B mall. You've not only really, you've got to class up the retail first, even before you think about putting in apartments, because people aren't going to, pay a premium to be next to a tired old department store they don't want to go to anywhere.
Well, it's true. It's true. But let's recognize, James, what the history of the U.S. mall was. The history of the U.S. mall, if I go back to the late 1970s and early 80s, the malls were put up really, really quickly. And part of the financing package for it was being able to secure a department store tenant. And that department store tenant in the early 1980s dictated what other tenants could and could not be in the shopping mall. And part of what we're talking about is, yes, there are some B and C malls that should be blown up, that should be just plowed under. But there are other malls that you and I, as researchers, know have potential, that they sit in the right place, that the mix of people within an easy commuting distance of that, that the transformation of that from the standpoint of an urban planning exercise from a aging, tired, dirty, abandoned shopping mall into a new modern edge city. It takes vision. It takes money. and it takes time.
In your years of studying the retail environment, do you think, compared with when you started, compared with today, do you think that retail environments are better for the average shopper?
Part of what is interesting is that the retail world and the development world is now recognizing that they need a better combination of art and science. That one of the dirty secrets of the retail design world was that up until really the past 10 years, a remarkable number of prize-winning stores were closed within a year of opening because the critics loved them and the public didn't. I recognize that the profession of retail design needs to have a better research component to it. I recognize that the world of shopping malls needs to have a better knowledge component to it so that that mix of art and science is out there. And the answer is unequivocally that the body of the beast of consumption is doing just fine. We love our children. Christmas is coming. Things are underneath our trees. We're still buying furniture. Our appetite for food and drink and our level of sophistication to all of those things is just increasing broadly. It's a question of whether the retail community and the development community is keeping up with the evolution of consumption. And it's the face of the monster that is in question.
I don't think we have anything else to add to that. I want to thank you so much for joining me today, Paco.
I'm delighted to have you.
Thank you very much.
Over the years, we've been lucky enough to interview some of the smartest people in the retail world. But there's still a lot of people out there that we haven't talked to yet. And you probably have some ideas on who we might interview. So why don't you let us know? Give us a call. We have a Where We Buy hotline, and if you leave a message, we might even use your voice on an upcoming show. The number is 602-633-4061. And if you don't want to leave a voicemail, you could always just text us at that number. I love to meet up with listeners when I have a chance. My next upcoming event that I'm going to be at is the ICSC Open Air Conference. It's in Nashville on February 26th through the 28th. And if you want to reach out, you can find my contact info on our website, wherewebuy.show. When I was in New York, I also had a chance to sit down with Ginger Flesher Saunier and Duncan Ward, both of the Ginger Group. They make, among other things, Hollywood-quality escape rooms, and they also do axe throwing and some other cool competitive socializing stuff. You don't want to miss our discussion, and in order that you don't miss it, just go ahead and subscribe to Where We Buy. We're on the iPhone podcast app, Spotify, or wherever it is you get your podcast. We're also on the internets at wherewebuy.show. A few episodes back, you might remember when Taylor and I were talking about Schofields. It's a store in New York with a claim to be the most interesting store in the world. Well, we went there, we checked it out, we rode the slide, we did all of the experiences, and you're just going to have to watch the video to find out if it is indeed the most interesting store in the world. We try to make our videos like visual versions of the podcast, and you can see them all. They're posted right alongside our podcast episodes at wherewebuy.show. Our theme music is Run in the Night by the Good Lauds under Creative Commons license.